Greetings from Thimphu to Slava and everyone around the world. Before starting the session, let's spend a moment to bring our awareness to here and now and cultivate the virtuous intention. Thank you. And thank you, Slava, for joining us in these conversations. We have been having these kind of conversations for over a year now. And we have been having this mainly to promote the awareness of Buddha nature, which I think is a very important and very useful concept in our times to combat negativity and wicked world syndrome and all the problems we face and the kind of very pessimistic outlook we have on life sometimes. But for the Buddhist scholars and practitioners, Buddha nature is such an important topic, not only a very profound topic, but also a very fascinating, intriguing topic. And we see it come all the way from the early sutras talking about the luminous nature of the mind, then coming down to discuss how it's really the ground of samsara and nirvana, and thereby also becomes a very crucial topic for practice. And I think one of the main reasons why Buddha nature has been such a captivating and important topic is also because it has engaged so many scholars, starting from Nagarjuna and Maitreya or Asanga in India, all the way down to our times. And among these scholars, Shakya Chopin is definitely such a brilliant sort of a thinker on Buddha nature. And you are, I would say, the foremost expert on Shakya Chopin. I don't know anyone who would know Shakya Chopin more than you do. So it's a great pleasure for us to have you to share your sort of insights and your understanding of Shakya Chopin's interpretation of Buddha nature. So thank you. But before we get into that, I often ask this to our guest: when did you first come across these Buddha nature teachings, and what was your first impression? Or do you have any? Through this, we want to actually know how you came about the Buddhist teachings, how you ended up being who you are right now.
Yeah, that's not a very long story, but yeah, it spans over, I don't know, 30, 40 years or something like that. I think when I was 15 or 16 years old, I read a couple of books in translation, of course, at the time. One was the Diamond Cutter Sutra, right? Vajracchedika, Prajnaparamita Sutra. That basically goes into negations, affirmations, negations, negations. And the other one was Lankavatara Sutra. Descent to Lanka Sutra. So obviously in the second one, there's some discussion of the Buddha nature. At the time, I couldn't understand pretty much anything, but maybe that was the beginning, you know? And then later when I started studying with Tibetans, of course, the topic of the Buddha nature would always pop up whenever you are talking about things like the Buddhist path, reality, awakening, practice too, right? It never was the main focus of my research, but obviously when when I'm studying Shakya Chogden, writing about Shakya Chogden, he talks about the Buddha nature quite a bit, right? So I guess that's a brief thing, you know. Later I can talk a little bit about how I encountered Shakya Chogden himself, right?
You have spent quite a long time with the Tibetan masters and in Tibetan centers. Yeah. But I'm quite curious to know how you ended up specializing in the writings and works of Shakya Chogden.
I'm curious about why did it happen. I don't know. Just chance, karma, whatever. Not, just name it, you know. But basically what happened is when I came to study with Tibetans to India, right? I had a choice, basically. One of the lamas said, you know, want to study Sakya, go to study Sakya. Want to go to study Geluk, go to study Geluk. I know both people in both places. So what's your choice? And somehow I thought, let me try Geluk first. I don't know why. And so I ended up studying for 6 years at the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics, you know, Tsenilapta, right, in Dharamsala. Dharamsala in northern India, where, you know, the Tibetan government is exiled, and lots of Tibetans live there. And it was very, very fruitful, very, very helpful. And obviously I was studying things like, you know, logic and, you know, Maitreya commentaries on Prajnaparamita sutras and basic stuff, you know. And of course, Tsongkhapa's works on Madhyamaka, you know. Definitive, interpretive meanings of the Buddha's teachings and the basic stuff. But then at a certain point, I sort of started questioning some ideas about some what I have learned about emptiness, what I have learned about interpretation of Madhyamaka, interpretation of Yogacara, interpretation of the Buddha nature for that matter, right? And somehow everything came together, you know. At a certain point, I was in Bodh Gaya I read a couple of commentaries. One was Mipham's commentary, the famous Nyingma thinker, right? Mipham, his commentary on, I think it was Novoketaka, the commentary on the wisdom chapter on that goes into refutations, of course, of some of the Geluk views. And then also Gurampa's commentary, Tawa Shenje, differentiating the views. That also goes into refutations of Tsongkhapa on the one hand and Dolbopa on the other hand. And basically, my mind somehow opened to all this huge field, very interesting field of Tibetan polemics on the nature of reality, Buddha nature, contemplative practices, and whatnot, just name it, right? Anything you want to say will be challenged by someone else, right? In another tradition, somewhere, right? And so I got really interested in that. And right then, I met very, very nice Lama, Kyunga Wanchu, who was the head Kimpo, abbot teacher of Dzongsar Institute. He was just circumambulating the Mahabodhi temple there. And I started asking him different questions. And he said, yeah, if you want to study Sakya stuff, just come to Dzongsar and we'll give you food, room. And I ended up just going there. And so I went to Bir. Bir is a place a few hours away from Dharamsala. And I spent about 3 years studying there, studying at Dzongsar Institute, studying Sakya stuff, Gurampa's commentaries, of course, also studying privately with, for example, Kimbo Kyunga Wanchuk, studying the three types of vows by Sakya Pandita, Gurampa's Donsung Kakon, the supplementary writing on the three types of vows that goes into the topic of the Buddha nature, right? And also studying Nyingma at the same time with Kimpo Tsewan Sunam at another monastery right there in Bir. And so then by sheer chance, I just went to the Dzongsar Institute library and found those beautiful books, you know, tiny little red books, the collected works of Shakyachurta. And just started reading them and something clicked in my mind and I thought that this is really, really interesting. I want to learn more about it. And I kept reading, and I still keep reading Shakyachurta instructions. So that's basically the story, okay?
That's fascinating. I think our time in Dharamsala and Bir might have overlapped. I was teaching in Dharamsala in 1992 and 3.
I was definitely there.
And I also spent time in Bir with Pendo Rinpoche. Now, I don't know why we didn't bump into each other. But of course, we have a common friend, Kenpo Seong, who taught you and who's a very close friend of mine.
Yeah. I learned a lot from him, Monchenpa's writings, Mipham's writings.
Another thing we share, perhaps, is even when I read Shakya Chogden for the first time, mm-hmm. I think you could sense that intellectual brilliance in him. He's so very clear and lucid in his presentation, but at the same time, he has that sort of intellectual verb showing a very distinct philosophical position. So going into that, can you share a bit about the life and works of Shakya Chogden generally to set the context for his understanding of the nature?
Pretty much everything we know about his life is coming from his biography by Kyungar Jochok, right? Actually, Junampa scholar. So that's basically all we know. It is all I know about Shakya Chogden's life, right? So he was born in 1428, passed away in 1507. He was Sakya. He always remained Sakya, but he also received lots of teachings of different Kagyu lineages from obviously his lamas, who were like sort of also doing both Sakya and Kagyu, he, until he was about 40 years old, he was just an ordinary Sakya scholar, basically writing basic stuff like commentaries on Abhisamaya Alamkara and Madhyamaka, and nothing outstanding. But then at a certain point, he went to Mustang, Dolbo, right? And spent some time there. And he learned that some people, sort of he started talking to some scholars there, some monks, about the key text in the Sakya tradition, right? Domsum Ramye, the differentiation of the three types of vows. Allegedly the first polemical text written by in Tibet, right, by Sakya Pandita, that refutes lots of different views on such topics as emptiness, Buddha nature, and lots of other stuff, right? And it looks like people couldn't give him any satisfactory answer on some of the questions he had. And he decided to just write down the list of questions, more than 100 questions there, and just send it all over Tibet, you know, to different lamas in Tibet, saying, okay, answer. And that made many people upset because they thought that that guy is just, he is criticizing the most important lama thinker within our tradition, right? Sakya Pandita. Even though he did not intend that, at least he said that he didn't intend that. And so many people started responding, including such people as Gurampa, for example, who became the mainstream Sakya thinker. But he was not satisfied with that stuff. And then he wrote his own reply to his questions. That the title for that text is Sergiturma, the Golden Lance. And basically around that time, he started changing his views, 40 plus years old. He started questioning Tibetan interpretations of the nature of Madhyamaka and Yogacara, for example. Also the question of how you interpret the Buddha nature and many, many, many other things. So his views changed and he kept sort of updating his views throughout his life. You can see the shift, in his interpretations of say, Buddha nature, since we're talking about the Buddha nature, before he was 14 years old and after. So he kept writing commentaries on multiple topics, increasingly sort of focusing more and more on tantric stuff closer to the end of his life. And so you find his interpretation of the Buddha nature in the non-tantric writings, but also in later in tantric writings as well. Written a couple of very important texts that deal with that topic were written just a few years before he passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was a Sakyapa by sort of institutional affiliation, and he also of course held a Sakya lineage. But then his philosophical understanding seemed to have sort of diverged from the mainstream Sakyapa understanding. And not only was his questions, which he said regarding Sakya Pandita's three vows, probably were really serious questions he had while he might not have dared to say the Sapien is wrong, I was wondering whether actually deep in his mind he felt some of those things that Sakyapendra said are wrong, because especially on topics like Mahamudra, Shakya Chokhten seemed to defend Mahamudra of his time. Sakyapendra seemed to criticize Mahamudra a lot. So talking about Mahamudra, specifically Buddha nature, let's say on this theme, what would be his salient, sort of his unique interpretation of Buddha nature that diverged from the mainstream Sakya interpretation?
I guess one thing, you just mentioned about whether, the question whether he thought that Sakya Pandita was wrong, you know? That's one point to address. And the other one, of course, is his interpretation of the Buddha nature. So one thing we should keep in mind, I guess, is that it's a general Tibetan strategy to, for example, when you talk about the teachings of the Buddha, right? There's so much attributed to the Buddha that you have to somehow sort it out, right? And the way to do it, when you find certain contradictions, you start talking about definitive and interpret, right? Or you start talking about intention. Let me tell you what the Buddha really meant, right? When he addressed that crowd, or when he addressed that crowd. I know, you don't, you know? Like that. And so Shakya Chokhten was using the same strategy pretty much, saying that, let me tell you what Sakya Pandita really meant. You know? In the three types of vows by Sakya Pandita, right? Sakya Pandita refutes the view that the Buddha nature can be dedicated, etc. Refutes certain views on the Buddha nature, right? And he says his own position on the Buddha nature is that the Buddha nature is just choje, right? Freedom from elaborations, freedom from conceptual elaborations. That's what the Buddha nature is. Doesn't have divisions, it's just, that's it, you know, simple as it is. But then Shakya Chokhten, who by that time already is very much interested in Yogacara works and takes them seriously, unlike most Tibetan thinkers who think that Yogacara is below Madhyamaka, right? And he says, no, Yogacara view is also, at least the ultimate Yogacara view is the valid, a valid type of Madhyamaka view, right? And obviously it's more than just tradition or freedom from elaborations when we're talking about ultimate reality or the Buddha nature. And so now he's saying, okay, Sakya Pandita said that, but he said that when he assumed the Madhyamaka point of view. In fact, Sakya Pandita very much agreed with what I'm going to tell you. Let me now tell you what he really meant, you know? That's it, the same strategy. You know, but now, instead of talking about the Buddha, we're talking about Sakya Pandita, right? Oh, your sound.
So a lot of hermeneutic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about Shakya Chokhten's sort of understanding of Buddha nature, can you first tell us the main sources that contains these views, and then what each of these sources sort of bring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously when we talk about the Buddha nature, it's much more than just Ratna Gotra Vibhaga or something like that, right? You have multiple sources. And so most Tibetan thinkers, when they talk about Buddha nature, their views are informed in part by something coming from Pramana or logical texts, something coming from tantric texts, something coming from Madhyamaka texts, and so forth, right? And of course, Ratna Gotra Vibhaga is one of the main texts, but it's just one of many, right? And so Shakya Chokhten is basically similar to other thinkers in that respect, right? So
Sorry, what I mean is his own writings. Where do we find his...
Buddha
understandings in his works, because there are 24 volumes of his writings, isn't it?
Yeah. I have this whole list of his works in one of my articles there. That's available on your website, right? Reburying the Treasure, maintaining the continuity. So it has lots of sort of references there to different works. But there, I didn't talk much about the tantric stuff. So he has separate works on tantric works where he talks about the Buddha nature. So let me share the screen then now. And so the audience has, of course, access to this, right? Then, can you see it now?
Yes, we can see, yes.
Okay. Yeah, so let's see. So if you look at his non-tantric works, right? One of the earliest commentaries he wrote was when he was less than 30 years old, right? Where he followed Rontön, one of his main teachers. So where he basically, explained Tathagatagarbha or Buddha nature in a way Rontön explained it. But later, he composed two very important treatises that I translated in my article, right? On the one called Reburying the Treasure, Maintaining the Continuity. So the Essence of Sutras and Tantras, that's the one that was written in 1474. And the other one, we don't have the exact date, but it definitely is later. Four different reasons I can explain. So the Sun Unseen Before, or the Previously Unseen Sun, where he presents quite a different take on the Buddha nature. So if you compare those two texts, there's some continuity there. But at the same time, he assumes quite a different perspective on the Buddha nature in those texts, okay? And then later, when we fast forward to the tantric writings, so here we have two very important texts, Sevenfold Treasure of Gems. It's basically a commentary on Guhyasamaja Tantra that he composed in just 3 years before he passed away. And the other one is the Thorough Establishment of the Glorious Original Buddha. That is the commentary on Chakrasamvara, in particular dealing with the body mandalas and so forth. So in those commentaries, you have a lot of talk about Buddha nature, either directly or indirectly, And so there you have sort of, he kept developing his views, and the view he develops there agrees pretty much with what he said, in the Sun Unseen Before, or the Previously Unseen Sun, But he, now it's in the tantric context. Okay, so those are the main texts, the four main texts. But there are lots of texts where he addresses the topic of the Buddha nature, in passing, or maybe focuses on some aspects of it. Okay,
so at least in some of these works, would it be fair to say that Shakya Chogden sort of diverged from the mainstream Shakya understanding, such as what Sapin presented as Buddha nature being just sutta, freedom from elaborations, the state of emptiness. But he added onto the state of emptiness or sutta also the awareness aspect, the aspect of that clear sort of cognitive presence, the Ishe aspect. Is it fair to say that Shakya Chogden understood Buddha nature also, or not necessarily Buddha nature? I think there's even a trick there in the kind of terms he uses. He doesn't like to say there is Sangiki Ningpo or Deshik Ningpo in these ancient beings, but he accepts that there is Gotra, Rik, and Kam, Dhatu in the ancient beings. So when you talk about Rik and Kam, he seemed to bring in a Ishi element to the Gotra and Dhatu. Is that,
there's so much to much to say about that. First of all, when we talk about the mainstream Sakya, it's very important to keep in mind that what is said in sutric or non-tantric works by Sakya thinkers and what is said in tantric works by Sakya thinkers is not necessarily the same. Secondly, when we talk about the Buddha nature, Tibetans traditionally follow the what we call the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, right? So the the first turning, all attributed to the Buddha himself, right? You have the turning on the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, the teachings on universal emptiness, right? And then you have the third one, the so-called thorough differentiation, teachings, right? That sort of differentiated between the three natures, etc., right? And so Shakyamuni then is not alone in presenting Buddha nature differently depending on what context we're talking about, okay? I was just leafing through Gurampa's collected works. We have 13 volumes left of his works. Allegedly there was much more, but right now we have only 13 volumes, right? And so you can see that when Gurampa, the leading Sakya thinker, when he is talking about the Buddha nature in the tantric context, he's clearly saying that according to the Sakya masters, he's referring to the founding masters, the five founding figures, the Buddha, the ultimate reality is the union of clarity and emptiness, which spontaneously has all the Buddha qualities in it. Okay, so what can be closer to the Buddha nature, right? But when we're talking about sutric writings, then it's different. Then we're talking about freedom from liberations, etc. And Shakyamuni then is doing the same thing. He is saying, okay, let me tell you what the Buddha said in the second turning of the well. And now let me tell you what he said in the third turning of the well. And he presents it quite differently, okay? And you mentioned also Gotra, right? The Rig or lineage, right? And Kham or Dhatu. He doesn't treat all of them as the same. For him, those are different ways of looking at call it the nature of our mind or potential or reality, etc. Right? So we can talk about that later. But I just wanted to make it clear that it's very difficult to talk about this Akya view because I think we always have to keep in mind the context. Okay.
Yeah, I think that also applies to many other thinkers, right? Even I was sharing earlier, I think in one of the conversations that somebody like Chandrakirti, who we always associate with somebody who considered Buddha nature as a provisional teaching, when you look at his tantric commentaries, would have a very different position from what he had in his Madhyamaka Avatara. So if we just, for the moment, keep the conversation in the sutra context, and particularly the second and the third turning of the wheel, in sort of Mahayana Madhyamaka context. What I was finding a bit difficult to understand with Shakyamuni is really the use of the terminology. While most other scholars would take Buddha Gotra, now Sanghigirik, or Buddha Dhatu, and Buddha Tathagata Garba, or Buddha Garba, as almost synonymous, he seemed to just single out Tathagata Garba as only something that comes with the manifest qualities after the Bodhisattva Bhumis and can't be applied to the sentient beings. And
because for him, basically, come or the Dhatu in this case, right? It's just a potential, right? All of us have the potential to become Buddha, right? Naturally, you don't have to achieve the first Bodhisattva Bhumi to have come. Likewise, when we're talking about two types of water, right? The naturally present and developmental, right? Developing. Yeah. The first one is, again, the potential. The second one is all the different practices we engage in on the way to Buddha. While the Buddha nature is different. So for him, the Buddha nature, what distinguishes his views from the views of many other thinkers, including from the view he expressed in his earliest commentary. If you look here on the screen, right, you see he's talking about the natural purity of mind, right? Sort of what he's saying in the later commentaries is that the Buddha nature necessarily has to be identified from the point of view of having positive qualities, either all or at least some. We're talking about positive qualities of the Buddha, such as 10 powers, etc., right? So that's the idea. And you can have those positive qualities only when you become free from at least some obscurations, okay? And that's possible only when you achieve the first Bodhisattva ground, Bodhisattva Buddha. That's his idea here. Mm. Now, he says that the second turning of the world didn't teach ultimate reality at all, because emptiness is, according to the second turning, is complete negation of everything. And that's not an ultimate reality, according to him, right? At least explicitly, it didn't teach it. But implicitly, of course, even the second turning agreed with the third turning. And according to the third turning, of course, ultimate reality is jnana, or the primordial mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so then, of course, he's talking about that jnana acquiring the Buddha qualities only starting from the first Bodhisattva ground, the path of seeing within the five paths of Mahayana, right? But that's just one way of looking at it. We can talk about later about another way of looking at this, right?
Yeah. Why would he argue that you can have the Buddha Gotra and the Buddha Natu without necessarily having those Buddha qualities manifest?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't have the Buddha Garba. I mean, there's no reason why Buddha Garba should be necessarily associated with the Buddha qualities. Even Gotra and Datu could be also equally.
It can be, but he's more, because again, when talking about, I guess the way he reads such texts as Ratna Gotra Vibhaga, you know, he sees that they are the, you know, the lineage and Dada and Buddha, they're identified from different points of view, okay? And that's why he tries to keep them separate. It's not to say that they're like completely contradictory or something, but for example, why does he say that the Buddha nature has to have all its qualities of the Buddha? Because he said that, you know, the famous quote from Ratna Gotra Vibhaga, right? There is nothing to eliminate here. There is nothing to accomplish, right? It's already there. So that's how it is identified. It means it already has all the positive qualities there, right? But he's very uncomfortable about with claiming that you can have all the positive qualities without being free from at least some obscurations. You see, so for him, they go together, always together. You can have positive qualities only when you become or when you are free from obscurations. Okay, at least according to this text we're talking about right now, right?
Yes.
The essence of sutras and tantras. That's the one.
Yes.
Okay. Now, one thing to add to it, I understand it's somewhat confusing, right? Because in the other text, in that previously unseen sun or the sun unseen before, he shifts perspective. He starts saying that, okay, now, ultimately, what he talks about the existence of things and non-existence of things. By the way, it's in many writings, he says that if something exists, it has to exist in reality and has to exist as reality. It has to be reality, right? The only real thing is jnana, non-dual primordial mind. Nothing else exists at all, okay? Of course, on conventional level, it exists, but in contrast to such thinkers as, say, Tsongkhapa, who says that if something exists, it has to exist conventionally, Shakyamuni then says, if something exists, it has to exist ultimately.
Yes.
The conventional existence equals non-existence. So then, of course, everything that exists has to belong to or be a part of or be the primordial mind. And that is also the Buddha nature, okay? And that's totally fine. But we're talking about the ultimately existing things there.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of shifts his perspective, you know? But when he talks about, so now he talks about the two types of the Buddha nature, ultimate and conventional. When he talks about the conventional one, he still keeps saying that it starts only from the path of seeing, from the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. Okay.
Yes. Yes, he's quite unique in saying that Tathagata Garba doesn't exist in the ordinary sentient beings before they reach the Bodhisattva Bhumi, isn't he? I mean, most other scholars don't say that. Yeah. One I know of, apart from Shaka Zhogden. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of them would consider Buddha Garbha, the Tathagata Garbha, as a potential without the qualities.
Yeah, but that's definitely, that's come, I mean, Dato, that's Riku lineage, at least naturally present, Renshin Nirik, right? Naturally abiding mm-hmm. lineage, but it's definitely not the Buddha nature. No, no, it definitely has to have qualities. And to have qualities, it has to be free from obscurations. And the way to sort of, to explain it once again, it's either to say that you acquire it from the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, or to say that you always had it, but you in this case, it's not an ordinary being, it's not a conventional sentient being, but the ultimate sentient being, which is equal to the Buddha. Only the Buddha exists, nothing else exists.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the Buddha nature equals Buddhahood. And everything else is just non-existent appearance, you know, phantoms. So in a way, yes, you're right saying that he is unique in saying that the Buddha nature has to have positive qualities, which happens only from the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, first Bodhisattva ground. But in a way, in that second text, he already is saying that this is just a conventional Buddha nature, right? The ultimate one is always there, and that's the only thing that exists.
Mm. Yeah, so the ultimate Buddha nature, or the ultimate sentient being, as he also puts it, is really the Dharma Dhatu, isn't it? In his commentary on Dharma Dhatu, he seemed to sort of agree that there is that Buddha nature in all sentient beings. But it's quite unique to find in his writings the distinct sort of the different understanding of Gotra, Dhatu, and Garbha, especially in the earlier works. And he is selecting or choosing Garbha only for those who are on the Bhumi level, which is interesting. Now, if you go into his tantric writings, he also talks about these sort of conventional absolute forms of Buddha nature. Resonate and then links them to the two sort of stages, the practice of generation and completion stages. Can you?
It becomes even sort of even more, because now we're not just talking about the Buddha nature having 10 powers and 4 unshared characteristics, etc. But now we're talking about mandalas, right? We're talking about Chakra Samvara body mandala, for example, Gokhi Samaja mandala, and all of that. And basically, his argument is that ultimately, of course, at the beginning, when we practice generation stage of Tantra, of course, we're just imagining things. But at a certain point, all those mandalas have to arise from within ultimate reality, not be constructed by conventional mind, but arise from within ultimate reality. And the ultimate reality equals Buddha nature, right? In that case, right? And so all those mandalas are the Buddha nature, or the Buddha nature is the mandalas, right? And so he keeps insisting that all of that stuff is arising from within the non-dual jnana, which is in this case, the Buddha nature. Okay, so we're not just talking about the Buddha qualities that are just different characteristics of the enlightened mind, but we're not talking about the visionary or dimension of the Buddha mind now, right? Because he's clear saying that it's not just that ultimate mandala, which is just the ultimate reality beyond characteristics, which is which we're talking about here. He's talking about actual deities that have form, color, shape, and all of that, that are the part of the ultimate mandala and, by extension, the Buddha nature. Okay.
In the context of this ultimate mandala, and especially when you follow tantras like Vajra and Chakrasambhara, does that mean that he has to accept the qualities of the Buddha actually primordially exist even in the
of course,
the Buddha nature of sentient beings, ordinary sentient beings?
Not ordinary, no. He says ordinary sentient beings don't have Buddha nature. Because that's really interesting, right? He says, whatever exists, exists in reality, right? the only real thing is the non-dual primordial mind, which is the Buddha nature, right? Ordinary sentient beings do not exist. Therefore, ordinary sentient beings do not have Buddha nature. It's only the Buddha nature that has the Buddha nature, which is the Buddha nature, which equals ultimate sentient beings. Right? He now he's dividing into ultimate sentient beings and Buddhas and ordinary sentient beings. Ultimate sentient beings are equal to Buddhas. Only Buddhas have Buddha nature, and only Buddhas exist. Ordinary sentient beings simply do not exist. As therefore, ordinary sentient beings cannot have the Buddha nature. He applies the same logic to ordinary consciousness. He says, usually we talk about the quality of consciousness, which is clear and aware, selirik, right? Selirikpa, right? Clarity and awareness, right? He says, only primordial mind has clarity and awareness. Ordinary consciousness does not have it because ordinary consciousness does not exist. Like that. So basically now the whole weight shifts to the ultimate reality, and which is the only existent thing for him.
Yeah, I remember seeing somewhere in one of his commentaries, he's struggling almost to interpret the He Vajra verse, not the very famous verse saying all sentient beings are primordially Buddhas.
Yeah.
I think he says something like all sentient beings have Buddha Dhatu, or mm-hmm. or does he actually interpret that sentient being as the ultimate sentient being and not ordinary right. sentient being?
Very clear. As he is saying in one of these texts I just referred to, he says, yes. Whenever it says that all sentient beings are Buddhas, but obscured by temporary obscuration. So the first part refers to the ultimate sentient beings. The second part refers to the conventional sentient beings.
Well, that comes across a little bit arbitrary to me. Anyway, let's stop here for now and then take questions. I think there are a few questions coming from the audience. So, Marcus, over to you.
Yes, thank you so much, Sava. This is fascinating.
I'm sorry that it's a little bit confusing. But
no. I mean, I think it's confusing by nature.
By nature. Right?
So it looks like Professor Yael Bentor is here, and she's asking what brought him to write so much about the Tathagatagarbha of specifically body mandala of Chakrasam.
Yeah, that's a good question. He had some visions of Chakrasamvara. He stayed in retreat on Hivajra and all of that, but at a certain point when you read his biography, he had a vision of Chakrasamvara, and maybe somehow he had some affinity with it. I don't know. But yeah, it's an interesting question, you know, like that text, you know, the thorough establishment of the glorious original Buddhas about Chakrasamvara predominantly, right? And so maybe personal stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you see, is there any sort of other philosophical reason it might have engaged in that way?
Not really. Somehow he started moving to teaching, given more tantric empowerments, teachings and writing more on tantra. If you look through the list of his works, right? Closer to the end of his life. And so I guess he somehow, as many Tibetan thinkers do, he tried to put together the tantric views, you know, and also the you know, views on the Buddha nature, ultimate reality, and so forth.
Right. Wow. Okay. So we've got another question here. Chitin Tinle is asking, if we closely look at the definitions for Tathagatagarbha and Sukhatagarbha here, they're almost mutually inclusive. And moreover, these definitions also seem to define Dharmakaya. How do you differentiate these two from Dharmakaya?
Yeah, Dharmakaya is somewhat, yeah, of course, Sukhatagarbha and Tathagatagarbha is the same thing. You know? And there's no difference here. And Buddhagarbha, by the way, for that matter, is the same. But Dharmakaya is, Dharmakaya is a little bit different from the Buddha nature, a little bit different, you know? in one of the articles here, let me see. I think it's, yeah, in this book, right? The Other Emptiness. So I'm even providing a little table here. So let's see what he's saying here. So he's saying that Dharma body or Dharmakaya, right? So similar to the Buddha nature. So ordinary beings, Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, right? They do not have it. But so the Buddha nature, they don't have it, but they do have it, but don't possess it. That's really weird. Like I said, that ordinary beings have the Dharma body, but do not possess it. Then Arya Bodhisattvas, starting from the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, they have the Dharma Dharmakaya and possess only some of its parts, similar to the Buddha nature, right? And then, of course, Buddhas have both the Buddha nature and Dharmakaya. So it's a little bit different from the Buddha nature, but comes very, very close to it, okay? But again, we're talking about what in later works he would call the conventional Buddha nature, of course. Yeah, so if you want to look at that one, it's page 187. So there's a little table there.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I sent a link out also to the book. Mm-hmm. You just mentioned the Other Emptiness. Great. I'm waiting. There's Christian Bernert wanted to ask a question from Facebook, but it's not appearing at the moment. Are there any other questions popping up right now?
Well, while we wait for other questions, maybe I ask you this. You talked about Shakya Chogden's commentary on Chakrasambhara, but he was also quite close to, or at least deeply into, perhaps Mahamudra. No, I was reading these three short texts he wrote on Mahamudra and sort of defending Mahamudra from Sakya Pandita's criticism.
So, yeah, actually, I never focused on that part of his writings, not yet. So I hardly can give you a definitive answer on his interpretation of Mahamudra. I should look at it later. We have a very good book. It's called Enlightenment by Single Means, I think, by Jackson, right? That talks about Mahamudra and talks about Shakya Chogden's approach to it. So maybe that's the book to refer to.
Great. So I'm wondering again, I'm going to go back to this again about the different Buddha natures, like that there's several types of Tathagatagarbha. Because I think that's what I'm understanding from my other reading also. So can you explain that a little bit more? So there's basically three levels or three different types of Tathagatagarbha, or how many and how does that work?
So basically you can talk about two and the second one, like tantric and non-tantric, but they're pretty close. So if you look, I'm still sharing the screen, right? So basically, okay, the first one is not his view. He just followed Ronturn when in 1454 he said that, you know, the Tathagatagarbha is the natural purity of mind, right? We're not talking about qualities, we're talking about the natural purity, right? And here is the same thing, right? In the mind, mental continuum of sentient beings, it's also called lineage, it's also called disposition, right? So that's not his view, okay? So we can pretty much ignore it. I put it there just to show how he changed his views, right? Now, in the text written 20 years later, right, he and the other texts later written even further later in his life, he started saying that only Mahayana Aryas have Tathagata Garbha characterized by the purity from adventitious stains. And Tathagata Garbha necessarily has to be identified in terms of having positive qualities of the Buddha, inseparable from it, right? And again, you can go to those quotes from the Ratnagoda Vibhaga, right? Nothing to eliminate, or it has, everything is already here, etc. Now the difference here is this. So there are two ways of approaching the Buddha nature. In the Essence of Sutras and Tantras, he talks about it as purity from adventitious stains, right? Which means that certain negative qualities have to be removed, right? Right? And that's only when it has the Buddha qualities. And that starts from the first Bodhisattva Bhumi, because that's the only time when one directly sees, starts directly seeing reality, right? In the Sun and Sin before, he does talk about the Buddha nature as the purity from adventitious stains and also natural purity. But now the natural purity, in contrast to the text written in 1454, right? It's not just natural purity like emptiness and freedom from elaborations, but it's natural purity which is imbued with the positive qualities of Tathagata Garbha, right? So, and then later when we move just to emphasize, so the Tathagata Garbha is never identified from the point of view of suchness or reality that has stains. Rather, it has to be identified as reality that has positive qualities of the Buddha and that necessarily has to be accompanied by separation from stains, right? Obscurations. Now, when we move to the first text here, the first text written from his own point of view, right? The Essence of Sutras and Tantras. So he says, according to the second Dharma chakra, second turning of the wheel, it's just a negation of all elaborations, but that is not the real Buddha nature, it's just an imputed one. The real one is the one coming from the third Dharma chakra, right? Now, when we talk about the third one, we have sutra teachings and tantric teachings in the third Dharma chakra. So in the sutras, right? So we have Tathagata Garbha, which is sutras, according to him, the sutras of the third Dharma chakra explain the Buddha nature in two ways, which is true, by the way. It's not, he didn't make it up, right? Some of the sutras say that the Buddha nature it has all the positive qualities, and that Buddha nature is present in all sentient beings. Other sutras, and also commentaries on those sutras, including, according to him, the Ratnagoda Vibhaga itself, or Sublime Continuum, right, Uttara Tantra itself, interpret the first type of sutras as having a veiled intent. So they said that all sentient beings have the Buddha nature, but they didn't mean it, right? And the basis of intent is that, again, primordial mind. That's it, affirming negation. So, and the actual Buddha nature starts only from the first Bodhisattva ground, as we just described, right? Now, a little side note here on what makes his interpretation of the Buddha nature even more unique is that according to the majority of Tibetan thinkers, the ultimate reality is either permanent or beyond any concepts or ideas of permanence and impermanence, right? According to him, the ultimate reality and the Buddha nature too is always impermanent, is momentary. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because that allows him to treat it as real virtue, for example. I'm writing the whole book right now on all those debates about the Buddha nature being virtue or not. And so basically he's saying that, yeah, it's virtue because it's, when it meets conditions, it produces positive results, so it's virtuous, you know? So, in any way, the ultimate reality is impermanent. It's momentary, it changes moment by moment. but of course it's permanent in terms of the permanence of continuity, It's forever there. For its continuity is forever there. Now we move to the highest yoga tantras, not just tantras in general, but Anuttara yoga tantras, so the highest yoga tantras. So now what Shakya Chukden said in his early texts, the essence of sutras and tantras, and what he said all the way later, you know, close to the end of his life, didn't change. It stays the same, stays the same. So basically, the Buddha nature of Tathagata Garbha pervades all phenomena, not just sentient beings. It pervades everything, animate and inanimate universe. That's it. But here he makes sort of like a instant distinction between two types in this text, right? Two types of the Buddha nature. One is just the naturally present jnana, the innate nature, right? That pervades everything. And the other one is the jnana of innate bliss, right? That can be produced only through tantric practice, the practice of the Anuttara Yoga Tantra, right? So that is the second one is the real Buddha nature, okay? Mm-hmm. And that pervades all phenomena because after all, everything is reduced to mind. Mind is reduced to the primordial mind, and the primordial mind is imbued with the bliss acquired through tantric practice, right? So that's the Buddha nature, okay? So as you can see, even in this first text, he's already talking about several types of nature and describes them differently depending on non-tantric and tantric context. And the main thing to keep in mind is that what didn't change when we talk about tantra, right? Is that that the Buddha nature pervades all phenomena. That's what he said there, and that's what he said in his some of his latest works. Mm. Okay, mm. So now when we move to the second text here, right? We're still talking about the predominantly sutric, non-tantric text. He does talk about tantras there, but the main point is sutras, right? So now he starts talking about, he divides everything, somewhat similar, by the way, somewhat similar to Dolpova. Right, so he divides everything into ultimate and conventional, right? Even though he is very critical of Dolpova, by the way. But so he's saying, okay, we have two types of Tathagata Garbha, relative and ultimate, right? So relative is newly acquired, you're basically pretty much what he said in the previous text on the sutra level, right? The ultimate one is has all the qualities present. And so when it's said that ultimate, that Tathagata Garbha pervades all living beings, that's the ultimate one. And living beings in that case refers to the ultimate living beings, right? When I said it does not pervade all living beings, here we're talking about the relative living beings. Okay. And so now he disconnects and he keeps pushing this idea throughout his writing. He pretty much disconnects jnana and vijnana, primordial mind and consciousness. And so primordial mind is just primordial mind. When we talk about consciousness, it always has the part of primordial mind in it, right? Consciousness doesn't exist, but on conventional level, we say consciousness exists, right? And so, and basically he starts distinguishing between, you know, what is real, what is unreal, and shifting more and more weight on the primordial mind, okay? And so I don't know whether I should go into details of this. You see how he explains those, you know,
we have mind, etc. Another question coming up related to that, which is okay, about then what you just said about sort of ultimate sentient beings, or that sounds a little bit contradictory. So the question is, what's the purpose of speaking of ultimate sentient beings? Although you kind of just answered that. And what's the distinction between an ultimate sentient being and a Buddha?
No distinction at all. Because again, he says that the purpose is trying to make sense of a tremendously diverse views on the Buddha nature coming from Indian texts, sutras, commentaries, et cetera, you know, and somehow position his interpretation within the still the Sakya world, you know? So that's the purpose.
Right.
And everyone is twisting words, you know, we twist them one way or another. As some people, scholars say, you know, the sutras are like rubber, you know, you can stretch them this way, that way. So people are just doing it in different ways, right? He is not alone in it. Of course, it sounds weird. You know? What do you mean by ultimate sentient being?
All right.
But he says this is his way of sorting stuff out. And he says that, so you have ultimate, you have conventional, okay? Conventional doesn't exist. So whenever it's said that sentient beings have Buddha nature, there is no other way, at least according to this interpretation, but to say that sentient beings here are ultimate. You know, the ultimate sentient being and the Buddha is the same thing. You know, ultimate sentient beings, ultimate bodhisattvas, and ultimate Buddhas, or just Buddhas, is the same thing.
Interesting.
I mean, what do you find a little sort of interesting or intriguing on his part is when you look at the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, which is the core classic that we use for Buddha nature. There you find the discussion of Buddha nature at three different stages, right? Whether you call it Buddha Gotra or Buddha Dhatu or Buddha Garba, you have the impure level, the partially pure, and the fully pure level.
Shakyamuni
is basically saying the impure level is not even the Buddha Garba. The Buddha Garba only starts at the partial level.
Like that verse, right? So. Again, if we're talking about the conventional Buddha nature, right, or what he described in his first text, written from his own point of view, that's exactly why he says that sentient beings don't have Tathagata Garba, because it's the impure level, Madhapa, right? It's only from the impure, pure, Madhagdapa, right, a level of when one acquires the Buddha nature, when we're talking about the conventional, right? But that's the talk about the conventional. So you have those three levels, right? So on the impure, pure level, you have the Buddha nature, which has Buddha qualities in it, but not all the Buddha qualities yet, right? And on the highly pure level, Shindu Nandak, right? Then you have, of course, all the Buddha qualities complete there. But when we're talking about the ultimate sentient beings, etc., then there's no any difference. It's just synonymous, you know, ultimate sentient beings, bodhisattvas, Buddhas, the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, his interpretation to me seemed to miss the point because, I mean, Maitreya doesn't really talk about Buddha nature only at the partially pure and the fully pure level. He's talking about Buddha nature across all those three stages. But then another side of Shakya Chokten, which really is interesting, I'm fascinated by this, which you mentioned earlier a bit. I think if you can discuss this a bit more, it'd be very useful for the audience. His understanding of Madhyamaka, no? How both the Nisavavada and the Alikagaravada are equally sort of authentic traditions in sort of comprehending.
That is his main thing. That's his main thing. Buddha nature is just a little thing, little part of his writings. But Alikagaravada, Nisavavada being all, both of them being Madhyamakas, that's his main stuff. That's the main thing, at least in the non-tantric world, right? That's very important.
And that seemed to have very important or direct relevance to Buddha nature, isn't it? He seemed to present Buddha nature being approached from two different traditions through Nagarjuna and his Nisabhavavada school and through Maitreya and Asanga through the Alikagaravada school. So... is that fair?
Again, what he's doing, right? What he's doing, he's trying to make sense of at least three different streams, right, of thought. One is Madhyamaka, the other one is Yogacara, the third one is Buddha nature writings, right? And of course, everyone is trying to somehow put them together or disconnect them, depending on who you are, right? And so what he's doing here, he's saying that, at least in his writings, written in his, starting from his 40s, right? When he started crystallizing his own unique views on Mahayana thought, he started saying that, look, you have all these beautiful thinkers, you know, wonderful books written by those thinkers, such as Asanga and Vasubandhu, and not to mention, of course, Tantric writings, where they talk about ultimate reality as jnana, non-dual primordial mind, and all of that. Then just to discard all of that stuff and say, it's just a little chitamata, forget about it, you know, we're followers of Chandrakirti. It's not good, very, very bad thing. So he says, let's take it seriously. Let's treat them seriously. Did they themselves say that they are not Madhyamaka? Did they themselves say that by following their views, you cannot achieve Buddhahood? Is there any valid proof, any argument that can prove that by putting the views taught by Asanga and Vasubandhu, you cannot become a Buddha? No, according to him, no. Of course, according to other people, sure. And so he says, they are Madhyamakas, those people, you know, Maitreya, Asanga, Vasubandhu. So all the leading Mahayana, all the leading Yogacara thinkers are Madhyamakas. They present the views, the ultimate view, the ultimate reality, differently from people like Chandrakirti, for example, but it doesn't mean that they are not Madhyamakas. Mm-hmm. You know? You can talk about, you know, these people like talking about apathetic, cataphatic, and all of those terms, right? So you can talk about ultimate reality in a negative way, in a positive way, but it doesn't mean that your view is not efficient. What he's saying is that, in fact, both the views of the ultimate view of Yogacara, which is Alikakaravada, meaning false suspectarians, meaning that even the subjective aspect of mind is unreal, not to mention the external world. So false suspectarian. So their view is valid. If you put it into practice, you can become a Buddha. You can dispel obscurations and you can achieve Buddhahood. But they present the view in a different way. So that's fine, why not? You know, and so he, so that's very important. And he has in this book, I have two main books on Sakyatrukda, right? One is this little one, right? So, Visions of Unity, where unity here refers to that, you know, the unity of the ultimate Yogacara position and Madhyamaka, right? It talks about his life and other stuff, but that's the main thing. And this book, it's like a sort of a complements it, because here you have the translation of two most important works that deal with, especially one of those works that deal with this particular topic, you know, of the unity of, you know, Madhyamaka and Yogacara. Sounds quite convincing. Again, sometimes you can see that people start twisting words and all of that, but everyone is doing it, right? That's his position that informs his interpretation of the Buddha nature as well, of course.
I actually find this his arguments about Yogacara and Nisvavada both approaching Madhyamaka very convincing. But my question, or something that I've been wondering, is this something that he starts to expound after some self-inquiry, or was he influenced and inspired by some other traditions or masters? His connection to Mahamudra, Amanaskara, perhaps, and then he seemed to put a lot of focus on Sosorangripa, no?
Self-cognizing.
Yes, so and that is so close to the Shepa Rangrig Rangsel of the Yogacara school. So did these influence him to argue that Namjinpa Alikakaravada is also sort of, you know, authentic Madhyamaka tradition, or was it really just...
There's so many things that somehow influenced his view, I guess. And some of them might be imaginary, some of them are not. But for example, if you can read his short biography here in that book, right? When he was still a kid, he went with one of his teachers to Pema Sampova, I think, to meet that scholar, Pema Sampova, and they discuss the Yogacara views. And his teacher held the ordinary Madhyamaka view, and that other person challenged him, saying that, what is your source? And his teacher cited Sutra Alamkara of Maitreya, right? And he said, no, keep going, sort of in that citation, you know? What is it? Lotan Dempa Nipa Merignes, right? All of that. So basically, that passage talks about transcending, sort of negating external world and negating consciousness, and then negating, basically coming to the state which is beyond both mind and external phenomena. He says that's the Yogacara view. Because majority of Tibetan thinkers say, oh, Yogacara is the same as Tsimtsampa, right? Tsimtsampa means Chitta Mantra, just on mind only. What does mind only mean? Mind only means that everything is mind. Mind really exists. He says, no, that's not your Yogacara view. It's the most basic view. It's not the Yogacara view. It's the view of Satyakarava. It's the view of the true aspectarians who claim that the objects do not exist, but subjective mind exists. He says the ultimate view of Yogacara is that neither objects nor subjects exist. What exists is only the non-dual primordial mind. That's what exists, right? And so apparently he encountered that dialogue discussion when he was still a kid and started exploring it at a certain point. But he didn't write about it. He didn't write here. Later, after his trip to Mustang, where he started, you know, questioning at least what Sakya Pandita explicitly said, on the way back, he met a great Kalachakra scholar, Rigden Traksan, I think his name. And so then again, they sort of discussed the Dharmas of Maitreya, Asanga's works, etc. And that might have inspired him as well. Mm-hmm. And later he starts writing explicitly, sort of pushing that view that Alikakaravada, or false aspectarian view of Yogacara, is Madhyamaka. And he said somewhere that, I've kept exploring that view, but I didn't explicitly express it. Now I'm explicitly stating, okay? So that's one thing. Another thing to mention is, again, when we talk about the Sakya tantric views, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, it's always the unity of clarity and emptiness. Clarity is always there. It's never like just non-affirming negation or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's clarity is there. Obviously, it's somewhat close to the Alikakaravada view, at least according to Sakya. Right. Mm-hmm. Other people will say, no. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, also another thing to keep in mind is that in, I think it's this auto commentary of Chandrakirti, where he says at the end of the auto commentary on Madhyamaka Avatara, Chandrakirti is saying that some people sort of didn't really, could not understand this view I'm expressing it here. It's right at the very end of the book. And so quite often, apparently some non-Sakya thinkers identify that person as Virupa, you know? And Virupa is the main, so basically Chandrakirti at the end of his text criticizing some allegedly Chittamatra thinker, right? Saying that that person didn't really understand ultimate reality. And so some scholars identified that person as Virupa. And Virupa obviously is the main tantric figure in the Sakya world, right? And so now you have to sort of, there's a little issue here that someone, Chandrakirti, allegedly claimed that Virupa had held Chittamatra view, while the Sakya thinkers themselves say that, of course, Chittamatra view is below Madhyamaka. So how do you solve that issue? Some people say that he changed his view. Some people say that he never had those views. But Shakyachuk then, obviously, for him, it's easy. You know, it's not a problem. You know, even if you hold the Alikakaravada view, you still can be okay, you know, just like that. So these are some things that contributed to his promotion, if you want, of Alikakaravada view as Madhyamaka, as real efficient view of reality.
Marcus, shall we take more questions or should we close the session? It's already an hour and 20 minutes now.
That's true. Yeah, we're almost. I think you actually just are answering. There was a few more questions that you actually just answered mostly. One final question is just that someone's wondering about contemporary thinkers in the Sakya school. Mm-hmm. So what's their view on Shakya Choktan, and do they incorporate that philosophy in their sort of contemporary views and their teachings, or did they kind of leave that to the side and they follow Sakya Pandita?
I cannot speak for all Sakyapas, of course, but I saw when I studied with in Dzongsar, for example, when I studied, when people study, say, commentaries on Abhisamayalankara, right, Maitreya texts, quite often they put side by side the commentaries by Gurampa, Tsongkhapa, Shakya Chögden, etc., just to see the differences, you know. When you talk to some Sakya scholars, they find his views amusing, interesting, you know. But there's no any transmission of his teachings anymore, of course. So you don't have the sort of the Tigun or something like that thing. So far, I never met anyone who would hold his views, who would say, okay, I follow Shakya Choktan. Okay. So that's as much as I can say.
Great.
That's why I'm saying that it's really strange and interesting that I became so interested in his writings, just by myself, opened his books and started reading, and here we go.
Well, by the way, this book,
this book, I started translating it like 20 years ago, then put it aside, and then finished just like last year, you know. So yeah, he's a really interesting thinker. So try to read it, and see what you agree with, or whether something clicks or not. Who knows? Mm. Especially his interpretation of Matyamaka and Yogacara is quite convincing. As Karma just said, his interpretation of the Buddha nature, only Arya beings, Arya bodhisattvas having it, Arya bodhisattvas and Buddhas having it, sounds a little bit weird and strange, you know, but when you talk about his interpretation of Yogacara and Matyamaka, it's just, yeah, sure, yeah, of course, at least to me, you know.
Thank you. I think that was fascinating. So the final question I actually wanted to ask was what books to read, but you already shared that. And I think if you are to start reading on Shakya Choktan in non-Tibetan languages, it will be your works mainly. So there's
we have this couple of books. Then, another thing, I think I should, even without being asked, I wanted to, I'm not promoting my books or anything here, but wanted to mention how his views inspired me, you know. It's because what happened is I started with Sakya people, first with Gelug people, then moved to Sakya Nyingma, and I could see how differently people interpret ultimate reality, how differently people interpret Buddha nature for that reason, etc., right? But those people, we're talking about real, living, wonderful masters, and teachers, etc., right? Great contemplatives. So I was very fortunate to study with people on all those sides, you know. But then you can see that, especially the interpretation of ultimate reality, the interpretation of Matyamaka view in particular, is like completely opposite if you compare Gurampa view, for example, and Tsongkhapa view. Gurampa is the mainstream Sakya thinker. Dzongkhapa obviously is the mainstream Gelug thinker, right? But then I thought, what if I use a somewhat similar approach to the one Shakya Choktan uses when he talks about Matyamaka and Yogacara, and try to apply it to the views of Gurampa and Tsongkhapa, okay? And so that's another book. Okay. Mystical, of course, sounds weird, right? Mysticism means pretty much nothing, you know? You can read anything into mysticism, but I just thought it sounds cool, you know? But the main sort of part of this book is about how different the views of Tsongkhapa and Gorampa are. And at the same time, if we find a way to read them in terms of how they contribute to contemplative practice, in fact, both of them can come to the same point. Sounds very strange, right? But but I was inspired by Shakyachudya because that's exactly what he's doing with Madhyamaka and Yogacara. Okay, so that's yet another book to read, maybe, because it's not about Shakyachudya, but it is inspired by Shakyachudya.
Thank you. Yes, so that's your latest book, I think. No, Tibetan Buddhism and Mysticism, or Mystical Experience. Sorry.
It's just mystical experiences, you know, in the Western world, people talk about, because what, you know, there's a debate going on between, you know, do all religions come to the same point? Of course, I'm not concerned about other religions, but in the Tibetan Buddhist world, it's an important question. You know, you have different traditions, especially you have rival thinkers such as Tsongkhapa and Gurampa. And the question is, do they come to the same point? Of course not when we're talking about philosophical ideas, but do they come to the same point if you put those ideas into practice? And my answer is maybe yes.
This is a very good way to conclude the session. I think when you talk about Buddha nature, of course, we have this very inclusive approach, Tsongkhapa, Gurampa, and perhaps even beyond, even if you go to Western mysticism or Christian, Hindu, Sufi systems, maybe we are approaching the same truth. We never know. Yeah, so fantastic. We have your book on Tibetan Buddhism and Mystical Experience. I think on Shakyachogpen, those who are interested should read your Visions of Unity and Radiant Emptiness. In fact, I want to add also, if you have Tibetan, then the original writings by Shakyachogpen are quite easy to read. And the relevant texts are also not at all long, both the Essence of Sutras and Tantras and the Sun Unseen Before are very short texts. And his commentary on Dharmadhatu Stotra is also quite concise and clear. And I think also some of his Tantric writings are like that. So, a lot of these books you'll be able to find on the Buddha Nature resource website. If you click or if you search for Shakyachogpen and Yaroslava. So please do visit our website and make use of the resources. And thank you everyone for joining us. Thank you, Slava, for sharing your knowledge and wisdom. And thank you, Marcus. Yes.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. Have a wonderful Saturday. Thank you all
so
much.
You too, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.